Okay. Let me start with a joke. Glad you think that. So I thought I was going to talk tomorrow morning, but I found out this morning that I was giving a talk. So I cobbled something up together, and I'll let you in on a secret. It's not such a secret if you read the room paper. I've accepted a postdoc here, and I feel a little bit of pressure because I feel like this talk must be tied to my plus one year.
You haven't even been appointed yet. So.
Right, so I haven't signed yet. Right, so maybe a little more than that. But anyways, what's also a little bit weird about this talk is that it kind of goes backwards in chronology. The Higgs missing plus invisible energy is something we and others have been working on just recently. And then I think tomorrow the first talk is about 4 taus, which is a little bit further in the past, and then four Bs is the oldest. So we're going kind of backwards in time, but this is something that I think is a natural progression. So this is kind of why this has come out later than the others. Okay, so other people work on this. I'll give you some flavor of this. So as I said, it's some natural progression. I'm going to give a slight background just so I can pose some of the. This is the discussion session, so I'm not going to say too much, but I want to kind of bring up the issues in order to get some discussion going. So I think we've kind of established that, especially in David's talk, that if you add a new state which the Higgs can decay into, it can mediate these non-standard decays. But one thing that's, and Radovan mentioned, I believe, is that there's a requirement that this decay has to be ultimately visible. Because the limits on a Higgs decaying invisibly has very strong constraints, just about as strong as the Lett standard model limit. And so one state, you're basically led to a particular type of phenomenology which must result in all visible energy, where the X is produced, two X's are produced from a given Higgs, and then those X's decay into standard model particles. So the natural progression is to consider what are the new possibilities if you include another state that the Higgs can decay into. So not only can you decay into pairs of the same particle, but you can also decay into an off-diagonal type decay where you decay into one and another of the particles, X1 and X2. So where I'll refer X1 as being the lightest guy and X2 as the heavier guy. And now you kind of have an opening of phenomenology where one of them can now be stable and the other unstable. In particular, what I'll focus on is where the heavier guy decays down into the stable lighter guy through two fermions, and then those lighter guys are neutral and escape the detector, so there's missing energy in them. So that's why it's missing energy plus visible energy. Okay, and as Radovan mentioned, and when you lack experimental searches for particular Higgs decays that you've come up with, unfortunately the onus is on the theorists who propose the theories to come up with the limits, and you have to hopefully give some rough replication of what you might think a real Lett search or Tevatron search would. Impose on that Higgs decay, and still confidently say that without as a model builder and you're proposing a new decay, give some realistic thing. So you want something in between, something that's not completely conservative or completely liberal about this. And so luckily there are some certain other searches that you can apply in different non-standard Higgses. So in the case of this missing energy plus visible energy, what we did was we looked at some past Lett results and thought of, well, what are all the types of searches that have missing and visible energy? So in terms of the completely, theorist rough idea of there's going to be, real missing energy, real visible energy, what are the searches that would apply to these decays? Now, the decays that we came up with were Higgs decays, where the Higgs decays through WW star, where one of these W's has to go into a lepton and a neutrino to produce the missing energy, or where the Higgs decays invisibly and the visible energy is produced by the Z. And obviously another place where you can get missing energy plus visible energy is super partner production at LEP, where the super partners decay into the standard model partner, plus the LSP, and the LSP represents the missing energy. So let me give you some flavor of how we try to do this. So for example, when the fermion F in the decay is a bottom quark.
Can you maybe draw what the actual topology is?
Sure, absolutely.
Hopefully make it.
So this is at LEP. And so what I want to compare with is a spottom search where E plus E minus produces a photon and you produce score spottom star. Compare it to what would happen for the Higgs, where the Higgs is produced with a Z. You have a heavier guy, X2, X1, and then X2 decays down to X1 through 2B quarks. So is that big enough to see, hopefully? So the spottom here, of course, decays into a B quark and the lightest neutral atom. And so if I take the Z to decay invisibly in this case, then the signal topology is just two B's and missing energy. Right. So the idea is that there isn't a specific search for this mode, but there is a signal topology that's been searched that you can reduce the Higgs signal to into B's plus missing energy. And so what we did was we tried to get some rough idea from the cross-section limits on spottom production from LEP. And I just took a random kind of a characteristic limit from here. This is in picobarns. So the cross-section limit we extract from this is about 0.02 picobarns. And so we're really assuming that the signal, these two different signals have it just once you've reduced to the same type of topology, have roughly the same type of efficiency. So if we're going to really compare this cross-section limit to what it would be for a Higgs. So for the Higgs, you produce it at about 0.5 picobarns, and you have to factor in the Z invisible decay in order to get to the same signal topology, and that gives you 0.1 picobarns. So you can see that at the face of it, this is completely ruled out. For 100% decays into this BB bar plus missing energy. Okay, is that clear? So there is some, there's some hand waviness, but it gives you some rough characteristic idea of what the limit is going to be.
That does
zoom,
it depends on the mass of the
Higgs. Yes, absolutely. So this is just a very broad brush, simple comparison, but it obviously can be very conservative. But this is just to get an idea. Okay, so in terms of this, you can then try to see in a particular physics scenario what type of limits are apply. So here is the decay. We're looking at this X1 and X2, where X2 can decay down into the X1. So there are some simple physics assumptions you could make, where X2 decays to X1 through some intermediate heavy particle, so it's a three-body decay. And so that, depending on what you think the intermediate particle is, it will tell you, what are the proportions of the different fermions produced here. Or you might think of a two-body decay where the X2 decays into a scalar and then into X1. And the scalar would decay, perhaps like a Higgs, into BB bar and taus, depending on its mass. And so depending on the scenario, you can derive the limits from all these different searches. And you roughly get something that, like, around 100 GeV Higgs is allowed, even with these conservative type of limits. Now, to give you some context of where this might come from, so far it's been model independent. We're just looking at assuming that the Higgs is produced at the standard model rate and that there are these decays, what are the limits? But of course, these can be couched in different models, some that are supersymmetric. Since that's a natural scenario where you get something that has stable light particles, they're neutral. So the natural idea in those cases would be neutralinos, where you would have a lightest neutralino be the lightest X1 particle, and the next heavier neutralino would be the heavier X2 particle. Obviously, you can extend this to neutrinos, and that's that just changes the spin of these guys, but it still allows the decay. And there are different types of model-dependent questions you want to ask, but in terms of realizing the Higgs decay, it's roughly, you know, it's just the same type of rough phenomenology. It gives you you would get some idea of what the cascade decay of the heavier guy down to the lighter guy, depending on the model. And there's also ones which have no supersymmetry, where the new stable light particles that are neutral are neutrinos, and they usually involve having right-handed neutrinos in the game. And for instance, you could have one where the lightest guy is one of the standard model-like neutrinos, and the heavier guy is some right-handed, like more singlet-like neutrino. Okay, and so they motivate the type of branching ratios you would consider in the different cases. Okay. So let me go to the first topic. First of all, of course, we want to consider whether or not these Higgs searches, or what are the potential Higgs searches that can be done, and there's very little work done in this regard. But I think at least naively, the most promising channels are decays which have leptons in them. So, for instance, if a Higgs is just produced by itself, and its decay produces two leptons plus the missing energy, the signal topology would just be dileptons plus missing energy. If the Higgs is produced with a W, you can get a trilepton signal. You could have just where the Higgs decay actually is invisible to some extent, and then so the whole, or the X2 decay down to X1 is invisible. So there is some amount of just completely invisible Higgs decays. And also, for instance, the scalar case can give you two Bs at a mass peak from the light scalar mass plus missing energy. Okay. So the thing I want to point out is that there's been some ideas of how to look for these. Let me say this. There's old SUSY searches for heavy Higgses that happen to have decays that look like this. These were more like the capital A0 and the capital H0. So there were some pretty negative results from those. So the key is to consider what is the difference. What are the new things you can do if it's the lightest Higgs? And the lightest Higgs has the ability to be coupled to vector bosons. And so there's this distinctive forward jet production production mechanism of vector boson fusion. So that's the one thing that seems to at least naively be something that you could maybe use to your advantage in order to look for these things. But in general, they are very similar to SUSY channels. So the issues that remain are, well, can this be seen? And I think as a theorist, you would say, well, this is a supersymmetric topology, which is generally considered pretty robust. But we have to remember that these leptons are very soft, and the missing energy is not going to be very large either. So the thing is that I know of some searches that have capital H0 and A0 being produced through like bottom fusion, you know, like at large tan beta, for instance. And then they have something where A0 goes down to chi2 to chi1, and chi2 goes down through chi1 to dileptons. And those were difficult to find.
So why would it be difficult to say in UMP if you have color?
That's not clear. So yeah, so I'm not saying that vector boson fusion, I was comparing dileptons through just gluon fusion versus this. But yeah, the problem is that to get to the W Higgs cross-section at LHC, it's going to be a bigger hit. But And the lepton branching ratio of the W. I think this brings up a host of interesting issues, not only just for looking for the Higgs, but more interesting, I think, from the point of view of signal interpretation. First of all, within SUSE itself, it's a supersymmetric model. It can suffer from supersymmetric backgrounds, so you have to be able to extract that this these SUSE-looking events are actually coming from the Higgs, even though you might be getting this also from supersymmetric particle production. But since this is a model-independent possibility, it does not have to be related to SUSE. So I think it's potentially very interesting because it could be confused with SUSE. And that you see some SUSE topologies that you would expect that only come from SUSE. So you could just be instead looking for finding this new non-standard Higgs that may be decaying into neutrinos like we saw before. Okay. So, I don't know. This is just from rough ideas we've had. We haven't explored this in detail, but I think these are the things that we have to worry about. Let me say something about the model-dependent issues. So if I consider that we're in a supersymmetric model, there are potentially some interesting effects within the SUSE phenomenology. And for instance, when you introduce this Higgs decay to a heavy neutralino and a lighter neutralino, something typically happens where the heavier guy has gauge eigenstate structure that is mostly Beano-like, and so it has electromagnetic couplings to all the superpartner, most of the superpartners. But the lighter guy is actually a singlino-like object, so it has no gauge type, a superspectral gauge interactions with the tower of the superspectral particles. And so if naively what this means is that the supersymmetric particle cascade proceeds in a very, in at least a two-step fashion. It'll go at most first to this heavier guy, and then finally to this lighter guy. So within each supersymmetric particle cascade, if this approximation is correct, this means that you have this decay appear twice in every event, supersymmetric event. So the question is, well, can we pick out this scalar, for instance, if this is the type of decay we have? Can we detect its decay? Can we measure its mass? Those type of things would then be very useful for finding or designing a Higgs decay search, because this is primarily the missing link in terms of concretely determining what the Higgs topology is. Okay, and so I think it's at least likely in these supersymmetric models that you're going to find supersymmetry first, and that you're not going to find the Higgs because of its reduced decay into standard model modes. So it's very interesting to try to mine this discovery of supersymmetry for as much information as possible. In this case, in particular, you want to look for the Higgs decay and motivate the Higgs searches you would do for it. But something else that we've just been interested in also is that this has some effects on the type of limits and phenomenology. And just to illustrate what that is, for instance, in Gluino and Squark searches at the Tevatron, if you impose this type of new decay, so take a point there considering before, and then attach this type of decay, you can consider that all the different types of decays that that you can append on there. And this is probably really hard to see, but so this is a M-Sugra plane. Here's M0 and here's M1/2. And so we've simulated the D0 Squark search, Squark Gluino search, and this is the search limit in the M-Sugra plane for the normal M-Sugra point. Now that you can modify introduce this lightest guy, and introduce the decay for the heavier neutralino down to the lighter guy. And so these two dashed lines, one is in blue and one is in green. I can't even see the green myself, so I think you'll have a hard time. But there's roughly, this is where the green is going, this is where the blue is going. And you can see that having a scalar that's above the B threshold and above the tau threshold does lead to weaker limits for Scorix and Gluno. So that the phenomenology is being changed and causing some interesting new effects. If you look at 3-body type decays, it actually gets even weaker constraints. There's one which is just where you have the 3-body decays are mediated by the branching ratios you would expect from an off-shell Z, and also one where there's a where you completely killed off the invisible part of what you would think of the decay, so something that's completely visible, and you can see that there's strong constraints. So, just within the supersymmetric phenomenology, there are obviously effects there. The key question is, well, once we find it, this suggests that LHC would have a little bit more trouble finding it, but it might take a little bit more luminosity. But I think that phenomenology should be mined in the sense of, well, can we find a scalar that's very light that decays into B quarks and taus, if this is occurring, in the supersymmetric cascades? Importantly, can we measure the mass of that scalar and determine the branching ratios? This, in turn, would then allow you to, you would know where you would have to look for the Higgs decay for the BB bar and the taus. So it would give more credence for looking at particular mass windows when searching for the Higgs. And in the case of 3-body decay, you want to extract the branch ratio. So these are things that at least people have considered before, but where these, for instance, the phi is replaced with a Higgs instead. You know, if the Higgs is produced in many of the supersymmetric cascades, can you extract it just from there? In this case, what we're trying to do is really just take, can we find the scalar in order to improve the ability to look for the Higgs search itself? And in general, how useful will this eventually be for designing the search for this Higgs decay? Does this mean that, you know, something that would be more difficult to find, you can actually, for instance, budget more in the trigger in order to, in order to not miss this Higgs decay? Or just in terms of, at the analysis level, design cuts that would better extract the expected signal? So these are the type of things that I think are interesting, and I think it may end up being crucial if this is the type of scenario we're put in. All right, and I want to say a little bit more in the sense that there's another type of scenario that I'm not considering too much in detail, but it's this one that Michael Grassler has been considering, where the Higgs decays into two of the heavy particles, so in my terminology is these X2s. And the X2s are right-handed neutrinos, and there's a reduced mixing between those right-handed neutrinos and the active neutrinos. So the type of decay that would go down from the heavy guys down into the lighter neutrinos is slow and tends to lead to displaced vertices. So this is kind of interesting because this is kind of bringing us back to the last workshop here at Davis, which was considering hidden valleys, other things that had displaced vertices, which for the Higgs case would have two, and they have many different type of things that can reconstruct to that, to those types of displaced vertices. For instance, two quarks and a charged lepton, and then there are also ones with just quarks plus some missing energy. So you'll see the two jets coming from a displaced vertex. Or, for instance, two charged leptons from and missing energy from a vertex. Okay, so since I haven't actually looked into these in too much detail, I just want to bring it up as a possibility in this general topology of missing energy plus visible energy. Okay, and the last thing I want to bring up, which I think is not particularly specific to this missing energy plus visible energy, but I think applies more or less to this whole non-standard Higgs business in general and beyond, is that while triggers tend to be a big issue. And I think, ultimately this is just a matter of dividing up the energy of the Higgs into the you know, the decay particles. If I produce n standard model particles, it means that roughly that the PTs of those n particles are typically just the mass energy of the mass of the Higgs divided by n, unless the Higgs is produced with some significant boost. And this is something that we had some experience with Higgs the four photons, but we've seen it also, for instance, the Higgs the four tau. So I think, you know, it's worth bringing up, and just in terms of a general level, is it worth it to consider a multiple object trigger with reduced thresholds? You know, most of the trigger tables that I see have, you know, a pair of particles that have maybe a 20 GeV PT or ET cut. So in terms of something, for instance, like Higgs the four photons, it's not clear to me that, you know, designing a multiple photon trigger of four photons and 10 GeV really bites into your trigger budget that much. And it seems to not only apply to scenarios like ours, like the non-standard stuff, but also Hidden Valley, unparticles and quarks, for instance. And so I think this is something that, you know, even beyond non-standard Higgs is interesting. And I think it's something that's just been covered by considering not only the non-standard Higgs, but also these other new types of ideas of new physics. And I think people are starting to get interested in this, but I think I would argue that this is something that potentially the LHC, you know, should really, the LHC collaboration should really consider, because this is just so general and could, you know, doesn't seem to require a big, you know, budgeting in terms of how much of a window, you know, bandwidth window you have. And so those are the comments I wanted to have. now we should discuss.
Do you know how time dependent the figures are?
How time dependent?
Yeah, how often you change them?
So, that I don't know, but I know that presumably there will be something that happens when you go up to higher luminosity, right?
Depends on what you want to do. If you want to change level one triggers, it's going to be very hard. If you want to change high-level triggers could be easier. Looking at the CMS trigger table, so we have double diphotons with 20 GeV. Mm-hmm. And the rate is pretty small, so, you know, in principle, asking for photons, it's not hard and can be done fairly late. The level one photon triggers for two photons, it's 8 GeV or 10 GeV for non-isolated photons. That's for 10 to 32. So that's definitely easy. Mm-hmm. So there is enough interest and motivation. It can definitely be done.
So I guess I still don't understand. If you're at level one, and you just sort of, let's say you want to trigger, as you can say, four neurons. Is that a trigger that would load? Is that a trigger that's in or not in your?
Well, for muons, you probably don't want that. I mean, you can just use the dimuon trigger, which is 3 GeV each. You cannot really go below 3 GeV in CMS, because it just doesn't get there to your muon system. So,
what cases look vulnerable to this?
Wait, what's the dimuon trigger at level
1?
3
GeV. Oh, I'm sorry, no. Yeah, dimuon is 3 GeV at level 1. Single muon is at level 1 is 7, but you understand the resolution of level 1 is not as good, but it's only a good muon system.
Like, is there any way it's possible to, like, so say at level 1, many different triggers pass the same event, and somehow you could then scale what the thresholds were later? I mean,
it's, you know, certainly, I mean, in principle it's possible, but usually it's difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, well, high level triggers are just much easier.
You can't go below 3 GeV anyway, whether you're doing 2 or 4, so then your 4 muon would be automatically the 2 muon. So
yeah.
The question I was about to ask is, what channels are two particles, what triggers of two particles are high in the energy or the key of the two particles that you're with some of these crazy signatures, you might want to go lower down again. I mean,
E plus tau.
That's right.
E plus tau.
E plus tau.
You want to go much lower there.
So for photons, I mean, what would it take to go? This is off topic. Like, this is not, I think, more for these Higgs things, but for other sorts of crazy things. If you wanted to get into the GeV range for Higgs for photons, can you ever get there? I mean, you have high knots, right? You
have.
That's probably.
If you mean by GeV, like, you know, just a few GeV, I think it's going to be very hard.
Yeah. So then that's sort of. But going down to 10, that's interesting. With 4 photons, 10 GeV is.
So Alexei cannot give an impressive impact next to 64 photons.
Why would you want to do that if you can do, I don't know, Higgs to... You don't want to have a trigger that looks for 64 photons, because each photon will have efficiency of, I don't know, maybe 90 or 80%, and then you have to take it to the 64th power.
So each photon would have one GeV.
No, but this would be one GeV.
I don't think you can do 64.
Those are buffer overflows.
But you don't want to do that.
So could you have a trigger with 8 one GeV photons?
No, you're fine.
But maybe related to this, what happens to events that have, that if you were to add up all the energy, they are very large, but it's sort of, add up, let's say, the total PT, scalar sum of PT, it was very large, but it's in many, many bins. Those
have
events
such a
now
trigger.
Are, what?
There is the HT trigger.
There's an HT trigger.
100 GeV.
100 GeV. So I mean, it's, I don't know. That's a trigger that sort of trigger that may have some efficiency for these things, right? I mean, you know, it's obviously not optimized for anything, but
yeah, that would be an easy trigger to implement.
But actually, 100 GeV is tough.
Because
if
you
want to just pitch some
HD. I think we have a sum EM trigger, don't we,
Alexei? So Alexei, what?
Some EM at level 2.
I don't remember.
Our problem is level 1.
To find out.
Their level 1 threshold is the problem. So the 100 GeV might require a level 1 above 20 GeV.
But that was my next question. Is for this generic cut, that's one that you might think would be a good cut. I mean, sorry, trigger. A good trigger to use for these kinds of many-body decays. But you said it's 100 GeV, so that sounds like it's kind of high, right? So, you know, for 100 GeV Higgs, I mean, it's boosted. I mean, it could be, it's not produced at rest, but, you know.
We have the trigger table.
So would it be, is that one of the ones that's easy or hard to lower? If you decided that was important? Maybe if you did it in conjunction with an object, I don't know.
It's a difficult question. I
think it's possible.
I mean, CMS right now has some very basic issues to sort out.
Oh yeah.
Like, there is an H-cal and.
Oh yeah.
No,
I mean.
Really?
Do you have any idea whether that would be it? Would that be a useful trigger? Do you have any feeling for that? I mean, that sounds pretty good. Your H's are not going to be produced at rest, right? So,
I'm sorry, Marcus, what was your challenge?
Well, my question was just, so this HT trigger sounds pretty good. One, you know, just if you have more than 100 GeV of total transverse energy, right, in your event, that sounds like that could be a pretty efficient trigger for these kinds of things. Right, even if half of your energy is in missing energy, but it's a light guide produced off axis, you know. I don't know.
And if it's lots of missing ET, you can combine it, right? You can have a trigger that requires HT and missing ET.
Right.
Depends on how big missing ET is.
Right.
Is 100 GeV of HT a low number, a high enough path that it doesn't, is that behind level 1?
I think it's level 1.
And that's the
that the trigger that's in the trigger table now.
I mean, look, there is no guarantee that, you know, when the signal starts, these will be the actual triggers.
Sure.
Because rates need to know to be very high. I mean, people talk about running HCAL without it being done, you know, like over the past few months, with global runs. So people are trying to run missing T triggers on nothing. And you have to set very, very high thresholds for missing T just to have reasonable rate of events, because noise in HCAL just produces like late missing T, artificial missing T. So, I mean, I think that, you know, to a large extent, many of the fluorimeter related triggers, they might change. They might just change what we have right now. I don't think there will be big changes in like things like muon or electron photon triggers. There could be some, we are off in background estimation by a large factor. But things that look in the calorimeter as a whole, and especially in the joint calorimeter part, could change a lot.
Sorry, I just, you know, I don't need to read it. Sorry.
I'm done.
Well, yeah, my worry is that, you know, yeah, something like that will happen and that you'll have to raise either, for instance, the diphoton trigger. But it seems like, you know, that if you have a multiple object trigger and the you know, the backgrounds turn out to be larger than you expect, you don't have to increase those as much in order to get it within the trigger budget.
You know, well, the way, you know, this, you know, if you want such a trigger, you want to find an experimentalist who's interested in this channel. And this experimentalist will make a physics case to the trigger group that this is an important channel, and you know, depending on their priorities, they will include it in the trigger table.
Can you remind me what your level one single trigger is?
200 GE.
But that, this menu is for what,
this
luminosity? 132.
Yeah, in the beginning we will start with pretty much a 5G two tower trigger. So we'll collect everything.
I think one question that all this whole, and one thing that's raised by this whole discussion of like the missing energy big decays is, exactly what's the best thing to do under circumstances when you have, there are a million models out there, right? And we don't necessarily want to go and ask our experimental colleagues to go for every single model and, you know, do a separate analysis, because we don't have a uniform weighting on all of them. But obviously you come up with these things and you say, I wonder, you know, this is a reasonable possibility, I wonder what the constraints are, and it's topology we just look for. Like, these are not ridiculous topologies, right? These are standard topologies that are searchable. And I don't know what the answer to this question is, and I know it's sort of related to something that comes up a lot, but it's, what's the best way to present data in a way that, if it's something that's so similar, like if you're talking about a search, I mean, in LEP it's a bit more straightforward because the entire environment is simpler, but still in situations where you have a topology, but it might be kinematically somewhat different, or there might be different angular dependences in the decays, whether or not there's some, and like I said, I don't know the answers, but how one should go about getting the limits on those types of scenarios without actually necessarily going back and saying, can you, you know, plug these through in the simulation?
I mean, wouldn't a good starting point be, you know, you would hope that there would be analyses that are, in a sense, model independent, in the sense that they don't sort of optimize cuts based on a specific model, you know, that are based on generic signatures like, you know, missing energy and leptons and whatever, things like that. And if those have fairly straightforward cuts and they, you know, they give you the expected background, the number of events, number of plots, I mean, isn't that good enough?
Well, but I think you can compare, look at the OPAL left, or look at the OPAL big search compared to the questions that we're talking about for like forecasting. I mean, there you have a nice model independent search, and it's got some limits, but we all believe you could probably do a lot better on tau's. So, there's just a... That's a situation where the analysis of tau's was not done up to the appropriate level, right? But I'm just saying, I'm just saying to answer the question is, sure, there is a model-independent analysis, but it doesn't necessarily constrain. The whole point is just that the more information you have, then...
Unless we have a possibility of that trivialization of these equations.
I could easily envision a situation where you, for instance, do the port jet tag isolate WW from SES, and then you would want to have a series of model-independent limits where WW coupled to a Higgs and Higgs became to a channel, just like the left, in other words, and you'd want to do as good a job as you could in this effective rate for every possible channel you can possibly dream up, right? So hopefully they would organize their data eventually in this way, in a fashion that left it partially but incompletely. You know, now we're wiser, you don't want to leave anything out.
Yeah, but we're now moving to a more complicated, obviously much more complicated vector environment. So just like you just did, like itemizing a certain particular like state with where there's a relatively narrow range of final state to get brought up to the very end, that might be useful, or maybe it's not.
I believe it would still be useful to be able to report model-independent limits on Higgs, WW, coupling times, branch events, different leads to the state X. I'm sure they can do that. I would hope that would be the way the data would eventually be presented if they see the different signal. And you can imagine also the same thing for W plus Higgs, X and Z plus Higgs. You know, to the extent that they can isolate those processes from the background, I think they can. There's going to be some cuts that they have to put in, but it's still like doing those kinds of effective cross-section limits in a relatively modern way.
Is that something which is in the cards?
You're talking about sort of signature-based analysis that would be usable for trying to use it.
But this is more than just a signature. This is sort of like beyond what Mark is talking about, where it's not just simply like a here's your topology, here's your rates, but it's actually suppose that I have W coupling to a scalar, and so I'm talking about W associated with some scalar, but I'm not going to tell you how that scalar is necessarily K. That's essentially what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. So then you categorize the effective cross section for the final state where Higgs decays to X. For a different X, you just have a series of plots like left. Is that some effective C squared, whatever you want to call it, for that channel?
So you're talking about, I'm not sure on this thing, you're talking about the separate plots for specific channels, sub-channels?
That's right. So, I mean, left has C plus Higgs. LHC will have that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So LHC will be able to. And what is left plot? They plot the coupling squared to the Z, which is where the cross-section comes from, times the branching ratio for the Higgs in some final state. And they give a plot of what the limits are on that effective strength, that combination. And I would certainly hope that LHC will have in mind doing these same kinds of plots.
How is it different from what, let's say, CDF is doing?
Well, they're looking to say, well, can I find the Higgs in this channel? Now, if you see a signal, of course, that's great, but we might ultimately be in the same kind of situation that we're in at LEC, where we haven't seen the Higgs, and we want to know what the limits are on some crazy model.
What prevents you from interpreting this?
Well, nothing so long as you provide the data in the way that I just said.
Well, we're not talking, let's step away from the Higgs discussion for a moment, but let's go into the discussion like a paper that Vito just put out with regard to Squirk crawling, you know, limits. If what you have are, if you have because it's all, in situations where it's highly model dependent, what your interpretation is, not even that highly model dependent, but.
So you're talking about what is a limit if I change, you know, some SUSY parameters?
Or suppose I just change the cross-section or branching ratio. I mean, sometimes you, if I have a particular cascade.
Well, cross-sectional branching ratios, I mean, usually if you go off the exclusive channel, your exclusion, if you want to change cross-section, I mean, the experimental result does not depend on cross-section. You exclude a certain level of cross-section.
Right, and so if the data are presented in the sense of this particular cross-section times this particular decay width, this is the limit, then I think everybody would be super happy. But oftentimes within a particular setup, like for instance in the standard model, right? I mean, the standard model, it's you're so BB bar dominated for the Higgs that it's essentially a BB bar limit. But there's also a tau bar contribution, and you can imagine situations in which those be combined. If you just do a limit on what the production on the limits on a particular cross-section for a particle which decays with this set of branching ratios are, and it's not always trivial to go back and be like, well, suppose you have a scenario where you turn off, suppose it's, say, leptophobic, or suppose it's hydrophobic, you can't necessarily go back and separate out those two different signals unless you have something which is a limit on cross-section time for range.
Well, I think that's the majority of, you know, let's say, you know, CDF results, you usually get the cross-section times branching ratio versus a parameter plot, and you also get this digested plot for a specific you know, model point where you exclude like a zero versus one, whatever.
Yeah.
Usually you get both.
You do, well, I prefer you guys to talk about it, certainly this, but in general you don't get a nice model independent analysis for your.
Well, many analyses are not model independent because you want to keep the backgrounds down, right? And you're trying to use specific properties of your signal to get there. Because
absolutely,
if you will be trying to do model independent, you will lose sensitivity.
Absolutely.
We have Bruce.
Yeah, right.
Right? Okay. He looks at everything in a model independent way, but unfortunately he cannot set any limits. So that same reason, because he looks at something very generic. So it's always a compromise.
Right, and so that's why I'm just asking the question, and that's why I'm saying I don't know what the answer is. That is there anything which is somewhere between the completely, like, can you tell me what the limits are on two jets plus missing ET? And can you tell me on what the limits are on N0 equals 200 and N1 half equals 150? Right? And I don't know what the appropriate, I don't know what the answer is that's between those two. Left a simple enough environment where, you know, each cross-section time branching ratios is able to be split up in a way that you can't necessarily, especially if you have cascades on different sides, where you might have different cascade chains and you might tag on one part of one chain and one part of another chain. So I don't know what the answer is, but certainly this is part of the problem, even going back to left now, where we can't properly interpret the results.
Well, I mean, even though, I mean, isn't that, though, I mean, isn't the best you could do there just, like I said, you have some generic searches that are designed to be pretty generic, and then you can run them through your model, and if your model came out after these searches and there's nobody wants to optimize a search for your model, well, you know, that's too bad, but there's nothing you can do about that. So, but it is very good to have these generic searches. They're maybe the best, maybe that's the best you can do, you know, for these, because I totally agree, there's no way you can run through every model, and you want to have, I think, a lot of these generic searches, so that if some theorist has, you know, a model that they think is worthy of detailed consideration, there's something with which they can make their case, right? If it does a good job at explaining these generic searches, maybe that's something that they should possibly be taken more seriously by experimentalists who have done a detailed search, you know. So I think, you know, that would be a very, very useful way to get theorists involved and enable people who are serious and who have a serious proposal to make their case that a detailed study is needed. And if something like these things are right, then that's maybe, you know, if there was a missing energy search and there were various, you know, generic sort of distributions associated with that search, and you showed that you could do a good job of reproducing that, then maybe then that would be a case to do a different sort of search that's more optimized to your model.
Yeah, but still you're left with this point, which is this, that if you have totally generic searches, then it's not clear that you're going to get any sort of interesting, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be something huge, right, you know, to see on the very general plot. I mean, if it's something like, you know, diffotic cross-section, I mean, you have to produce a bump of, you know, some enormous size, right, that you would have seen somewhere else.
Well, I mean, by generic, I mean something like, for example, missing energy in leptons, right? Or, you know, or if you were talking about like four photons or something like that, you know.
But so maybe then there's...
It's not necessarily something that has a huge background. I mean, hopefully it would be most useful, obviously, if something showed up that didn't have an enormous standard model background.
But then maybe this is something that's worth like categorizing. What are the sort of like generic set of, what are the set of model independent, you know, cuts that you want to do, if to the extent that a really completely model independent analysis of just digets is not going, or diphotons is not going to be good, and it's, you know, community, it'd be good to sit down and be like, okay, here are the, because even once you get into n leptons, n photons, n jets, n amount, x amount of missing energy, and x amount of visible energy, pairwise combinations of those still is a huge number. And then you also have the question of, I don't know to what extent neural nets are going to be employed, but certainly going backwards, trying to deal with neural net analyses from left is just a huge pain trying to, you know, you get some limit, which is based on some neural net analysis of a signal event, whether it's signal-like or background-like. And that's not like a cut, right? You can't just say, run your model through that old neural net.
But, I mean, maybe this is, this sounds to me like something like that theorists should be doing to get ready for LHC. This is really, I think, more our job, is that if to make a list of five, let's say, to pick a random number, you know, searches that we would like to see for these kinds of, you know, for people who are not interested in MSSM. I mean, MSSM is taken care of, right? But if you're interested in anything else, well, even that, okay, the MSutra is taken care of. But anyway, for people who are interested in, you know, anything non-standard, you know, if we can agree on, if there's some, you know, group of people with sufficient weight behind them, could agree on five or whatever, some handful of searches that we'd really like to see that would cover a wide spectrum of models to, you know, begin testing them. It seems like that's more our job to figure out what those are.
Why do we
need to
do it? Why can't we go to our experimentalists?
Maybe we all just do it individually, but I mean, it might be something that would benefit from some organized, you know, people getting together and focusing on this problem. That was meant to have a question mark at the end of it. I don't know. Would that be useful? Or should we just leave it up to, like you say, individual theorists should each push their signals and the free market will make work things out.
I bought the free market. Just less meeting.
It could be a meeting like this.
Well, let's see how good people.
Well, I think it's totally realistic. I mean, if there is this sufficient agreement that, you know, this, you know, 20 different sort of model independent signatures and these sort of plots is useful. You can always talk to appropriate conveners in CMS or Atlas, and this can be arranged, especially if these signatures are sort of derivatives or intermediate steps of specific analyses. It's probably not too hard to do. And if you take a typical CDF analysis, there is a gazillion of plots.
It
comes with a huge number of plots coming in with it, like, you know, you need two electrons plus missing T plus two jets final state, invariant mass of the two electrons.
Right.
But lots of those plots.
But out of 17,000 of them, 500 have five sigma excesses in them.
I'm sure.
500, did it say 5,000? 500. Which is way more than you'd expect from 5 sigma. You'd expect zero from 5 sigma. The model was perfect.
Yeah, but I think you want to precisely avoid that sort of a fortiori bump hunting, right? That's exactly what you want to do. You want to define some analyses ahead of time and, you know, have preferred, you know, decide what distributions or what quantities are useful and, you know.
His analysis is like the canary in the mine shaft. You know, it's your first indication that there might be something really big happening. But then you have to do a dedicated search.
So I mean, have you thought about what kinds of maybe either of you thought about what kinds of, you know, searches, generic searches you might be interested in?
Well, the only thing that I can think of is I had one conversation with Bruce, right? Because Bruce is constantly trying to update his bump hunter. And one thing that at least I don't know if he actually incorporated it, but in thinking about the Higgs four photon stuff, right? I just noted that if you find a bump in something, then it's useful to look and see if you find that, try to reconstruct, treat that as a particle, and then go back and run your entire simulation treating that individual bump as a particle, right? That's essentially the Mark 7 philosophy. I don't know how they're doing that. But
so you mean generate a model essentially that just has a branching ratio and so on, explains that bump as a particle, and now rerun and see if there are any...
No, I'm just saying that if you find a bump and it's really a particle and it's really coming from other things, then you should, every time you find an event where you have some particle that reconstructs to that, you should now just treat those, that's that particle as an individual particle. To the extent that you're running this all, I'm 90 silent about 4 vectors, but if you have some 4 vectors which always are reconstructing to some particular invariant mass, then you just combine those 4 vectors and you go backwards and treat that as a particle in your simulation. Then you can run your entire bump hunter again, except for instead of having whatever those final state particles are, you replace them by the initial particle. Like in the 4 photon case,
I don't understand what you mean by every. I mean, if there's a distribution background like this and there's a bump up here, so which events now out of
those?
Might be
just an invariant mass. I'm just thinking.
But I think all he's saying is, suppose you had the 4 photon, and you did find some bumps in 2 photon invariant mass distribution, and you should collect all events that have, you know, 2 photons in this certain mass bin, and maybe 2 pairs of 2 photons each in a certain mass bin, and then hunt for a big bump.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
But that's a very particular thing. That's not certainly not along the lines of like, oh, here's a good general analysis to go. Here's one at 20 axes. For the background, there's still switching below these 2 meters.
Kind of what I was saying, you know, turned around the way I wanted to do it, say, suppose you took the W diffusion, you would like, you know, the limit on an effective cross-section in the 2 pseudoscalar channel and the 2 taus, but of course you would want it as a function of the pseudoscalar mass. Right? You would want different things. I mean, that's the way the left limits are plotted, if you look at them. You know, choose 1 pseudoscalar mass, you get limits on the effective cross-section, you can change the mass by some number of TUV, and get another limit on the effective cross-section for that
I mean, I remember I a long time ago I asked the LHC Olympic days, I asked, I'm blanking on his name, he was in Seattle, he was our last workshop, experimentalist. Anyways, Gordon, Brown, I can't remember. Anyway, sorry, I'm just having a senior moment. But anyway, they were, the response he gave was that, you know, the acceptances are so model dependent. So, you know, ideally you want some quote on some cross section with some cuts, right? But because to know the efficiencies of these cuts, it depends on the shape of the distributions there. So it's really in practice impossible to, you know, quote a limit on a cross section, especially at a Hadron point. I don't know if that's...
Well, it just shows the difficulty, as I say, sliding it up into, you know, a given Higgs mass, whatever, a given pseudoscalar mass, then your acceptance is kind of pinned down. But if you didn't specify the pseudoscalar mass, it would be useless. So you've got to, you know, do enough different final states for enough different submasses that you really have, you know, the acceptance and so forth under control. It's a big job. I'm just trying to make, and that's something that eventually I think CMS is going to, you know, want to organize their results. And,
it's really hard to come up with a background model, though, that covers all of it.
Coming up with a what model?
Background.
Background. We were talking about just standard model background.
That's what I mean. Like, standard model is our background.
Right.
For the new physics.
Well, right, yeah. So we're supposed to understand that. So you're supposed to, no matter what channel I tell you to look at, you're supposed to know what the background is.
Well, to do that for thousands of channels is not easy.
I guess I have this huge, you know, disk full of these standard model events that cover everything, and pouring through them from a particular, in my example, Higgs and pseudoscalar mass of interest or something.
Example, you might have mismodeled due to imperfect jet fragmentation just how often a jet fakes an electron. Way out on the tail, that could be the dominant source of, mm-hmm. of what you're seeing. So it's hard.
Do people have, Marcus, do people have ideas about what we're talking about tomorrow afternoon?
Yeah, so maybe
it's trivial to make the Higgs data 64 function.